thousands and thousands of thunderstorms at any one instant of time around the Earth somewhere, they're making a lot of radio noise. When I go down to an antenna that has 30 decibels of loss instead of gain, because it's a 3-foot piece of non-resonant wire, I lose 30 dB of that noise, I lose 30 dB of that signal. The signal-to-noise ratio stays almost the same. The automatic gain control of the receiver takes over, and what comes out of the loudspeaker sounds the same. I don't hear any difference, but I can't transmit through it. You can listen to a non-resonant antenna if you want to. You're going to suffer 30 dB of loss when you do it. And you can't transmit through that because it's 30 dB down from a dipole, except for the guy next door. Nobody's going to hear you. So there's no great magic there. I think that is somewhat understood. Over to you, Alex. N2NNU. And although you and I seem like we're having a disagreement here, I think we're coming to a higher understanding about an antenna phenomena that a lot of people would like to know more about. N2NNU, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Here is a practical proposition. Let's buy one of those little verticals without an amplifier, but with a tuning element that sits on your desk. What is that? Telescopic antennas, whatever they have, cost about $20 or whatever, so you can resonate the vertical on the frequency you want. And compare the signal strength, and we don't have ALC, we turn off the ALC, okay? And we compare that with a full wavelength antenna on whatever frequency you want. You will observe that the telescopic antenna on your disc, on a disc, even if it is tuned, will be much less sensitive than the one that is full length. Not considering that you have that little antenna on your desk between all other wires and whatnot, all propagation being equal and so forth. Would you agree with that?
I agree with what you just said. I don't agree with the interpretation you're about to give it. Those two antennas are not in the same location. The full 80-meter dipole is up in the air, 30 feet above the ground. The center of it is an inverted V. It's on my tower. If I took that little whip antenna, that telescoping whip, or that little rabbit ear-like thing that was on your desk, and if I mounted at the exact same altitude, 30 feet up on the tower, and if it was built with quality materials that were lossless, and I resonate it, I will be within 0.6 dB of gain of the exact same signal strength, within 0.6 dB, that's the pattern change from the infinitesimal dipole, compared to the full half-wave dipole up at 30 feet. You got to do an apple and apple test here, same altitude, same location. And if I did it losslessly, now that little rabbit ear thing with the resonator, it's only going to be a couple of kilohertz wide before you exceed 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's going to be a very high Q narrow band antenna. But at the frequency where I resonated, and if I do it losslessly, and if I put it at the same location, I will get the same signal strength. I will get the exact capture area within a few percent. I know that's hard to accept. That's the magic of resonance at the same location. Over to you, Alex, N2NNU, K2LIW.
2KEY with a good example.
Okay, KEY. Okay, Dick, I don't want to argue here, but you seem to want to contradict the whole optics field and everything else that is related to it, so I will not argue with you. I consider that two antennas are in the same position. I didn't want to exacerbate it. I said it's a disc antenna, so you... RAW, go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't... back to you, Dick.
Let me explain it, Dick.
Yeah, stand by a second, Mel. There's another point that we've got to go here, and I know where Mel's going, and he's going to have a very strong point from his point of view. In optics, what you're implying, Alex, you're absolutely right. That telescope, if I half the area of the mirror on my telescope, I get one half the amount of signal. That telescope has a mirror that is 100,000 wavelengths in diameter. Area equals signal capture of that telescope. In the case of these dipole antennas you and I are talking about, the antenna has a half wavelength of length, half wavelength, and it resonates. Very different phenomenon. phenomena. In the case of a great big feed horn, standard gain antenna, area equals signal strength, area equals the amount of signal you gather. Whenever you've got a large number of wavelengths to work with, area is everything that counts. When it's an extremely small number of wavelengths, and now you're making up the area with resonance, not with real physical material, that 80-meter dipole has only got 1 square foot of total area of the copper, the 14-gauge copper wire, and yet it acts like 8,500 square feet of effective area on transmit and on receive. A half-wavelength thing that resonates acts very different than an optical telescope of 100,000 wavelengths of diameter on its mirror. Very, very different. K2KEY, who's got tiny little antennas in his shack, and boy does he do reception on those. K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
Right, Dick. You know, I've read about this. I've got everything John Krause has written. I have studied that in detail. Walt Maxwell, etc., etc. And I had to prove it to myself. And I did it by, again, you can explain to Alex about my full wave loop outside. That's 272 feet of wire fed with open wire feeders, 600 almost wire feeders into a specially designed matching network. Everything done to precise as possible for a loop antenna on 80 meters. And 45 feet up, held up by 5 supports. And then I go ahead and I experiment with an indoor loop antenna that I resonate. That is what? Less than one-tenth of a wavelength. And it will many times perform as good or better than this wave, than this monster I've got outside. How do you explain it to people? And until I demonstrate it, nobody, they just sit there with their mouth open, Dick, over.
And I can explain it, some of it at least. He's resonating that small loop that's in the shack with him, so therefore its effective capture area becomes nearly identical to the great big 270-foot chunk of wire 40 feet up, the real loop antenna. And the real loop antenna, by the way, is parallel to the ground, 45 feet up. The loop antenna in the shack with him has not only resonance that gives it nearly the same area, and I say nearly because the area it's trying to create, some of it includes the earth that's under him, and the damn thing is very low in his shack as opposed to the thing that's high up in the air. So there's a little bit of unfair comparison. How in the world can the antenna that's some of its area includes the earth and it's too darn low, how can it have the same performance? Because of its adaptability. He can tilt it in azimuth. He can tilt it in elevation. He can rotate it in polarization. That signal that comes to him through the ionosphere from his buddy in Pennsylvania or his other friend in London, when it reflects off the ionosphere, depending on the state of the ionosphere today and the amount of Faraday rotation, the guy that transmitted the signal to him may have sent out a vertical signal. When it gets into Mel's backyard in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, it could end up as horizontal polarization or anything else. And it comes in at some crazy angle. Because that loop in the shack with him, he can tune it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. He can match the signal. And some of the fades that he sees on the big antenna outside doesn't happen on the little one in the shack. Now, for a bunch of reasons, he hasn't transmitted to the little loop in the shack yet. But on reception, he can get equal and sometimes better performance on the tiny antenna. And when he tells people about that, they say, boy, you're making up a very tall story, Mel. Wow, these guys in Manhattan Beach, can they tell a yarn? They're telling him that all the time. But you read the appropriate section of the antenna handbook by ARRL, you get a hint. You talk to the few people who have made the leap of faith to do it, you get a hint. And so there's more to the story than first meets the eye. Any last question on this one, Alex, before we go over to the next guy? N2NNU. Good question, by the way. K2LIW on the deck net.
No, I don't want to put any questions. So only a suggestion to Mel. You can improve the efficiency of that loop by decoupling from your load. In other words, when you tune it, you're actually destroying that a lot of current flowing through it by because the load of the, you're applying from the receiver. A suggestion will be to have the big loop tuned just by itself with a capacitor or whatever, and then to couple with it with a smaller loop within the large loop. So you will have actually two coils. One external that actually is doing the receiving, and the one internal that is only probably 1 feet, 1 foot or less than that, close to the internal loop, to the external loop, and that will be your match, your feeding coil. You will see that you can get about 10 times more power, more receiving sensitivity out of it. Dick?
Oh, do I have good news for you? He's been doing that for a few years. And he's going one step beyond that. He's even doing Q multiplying beyond that. He's got an inner loop, an outer loop. He can adjust the coupling coefficients between the two, the impedance match between the two, and he's doing Q multiplying besides. Mel, give us a few more words on that one.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Exactly. I got the large loop, and then I got the other loop in. One I use, basically, I'll turn if I have a high noise level. And most people complain about the noise levels being impossible on 75 meters. I can take times when the noise level is at 9, and I'll set my loop, one head in the direction of the signal that I'm receiving, the other one headed towards the noise source. I adjust the adjustments. Of course, I've got a lot of adjustments. I got the adjustments on the antennas, the variables I have to set on the antennas, the peak, because it's very critical, and then I go through a noise squasher that you may have seen some articles on, and I believe they are producing them now, a couple of companies, and then a Q multiplier, and then into the receiver, and it's amazed. I'll dig out signals that on 75 meters that in most cases people actually have to call me on the phone to have to actually let them listen to it on the telephone. Because they don't believe I'm really hearing these stations the way I am, over.
Yep. He's got people accusing him of doing a hoax, that he couldn't really be receiving that well. He's doing it over telephone. And if you read the March issue of CQ Magazine, March or April, I think it is, where there was an article about the magic of radio, an article supposedly written by K2RIW, but it was really written by the editor, and I gave him the raw material. You'll see that I had a similar situation with my 16 Yagis on 432. Talking to a guy on single sideband, 432, 480 miles away, day in and day out. And people thought it was a hoax. And we did it for 4.5 years. And they accused us of doing it on the telephone. Boy, would that have been a phone bill. Half hour every Tuesday night for 4.5 years. And eventually people in the middle were hearing the signals in both directions and say, hey, these guys are really doing it. You put up a big enough antenna with enough capture area, enough performance on that antenna, enough transmit power, you'd just be amazed how far that signal will go. Okay, we're going to be discussing this for years to come. I know, controversial subject. Dan, I think you had a question. Hope we haven't kept you waiting too long. I think it was K2DLS. If not, there's at least one more person that I should be going to on the list. That person, go ahead right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
OOA.
OOA is a brand new person. Dan, with the K2DLS, I think you had an earlier question. Go ahead.
KC2OJO, Howard, with a comment on the previous subject.
Howard recognized. Let me find out who's the next person that I was supposed to go to, and maybe they fell asleep on us. Go ahead with your question, Howard. KC2OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I think I understand pretty well what you're talking about with resonance, but one thing does ring true that Alex commented on, but I think it doesn't change what you said. I was wondering, as the wire gets shorter and shorter, perhaps when it's resonated, the voltage is going down proportionally, but because the resistance is going down, the current is going up. You know, that's why the bandwidth is really going down and getting so narrow, because the resistance is going down, that perhaps the power is staying the same. which is really what we want, even though the voltage that's being captured, in a sense, is going down. I wonder if that might be true, though.
Interesting point of view, Howard. If you study what happens with a full half-wave dipole, that you slowly shrink it more and more, but keep re-resonating it, and you keep re-resonating it with an antenna tuner, loading coils, zigzagging, top hat capacitors, all kinds of combinations. You can keep re-resonating it. The full half-wave dipole, I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit, the signal has to bounce back and forth 30 times before it gets radiated. Let me go slow on this one. There's some real mystery going on here. Assume I've got 70 ohm twin lead transmission line. Assume I've got a full half-wave dipole in free space, which when resonated, 132 feet long at 3,700 megs roughly, 3,700 kilohertz, has a center impedance of a 72 ohm resistor. So here's my transmitter signal coming out of the transmitter, going down 72 ohm twin lead. It climbs onto the 72 ohm resistive impedance full half-wave dipole. Common sense would lead you to believe the antenna flows down that wire once and jumps into space. Uh-oh. The signal bounces back and forth roughly 30 times on that wire. So a perfectly impedance-matched, resonated, full half-wave dipole in free space on the wire of the dipole itself is something like a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio on that wire. Not on the twin lead that fed it, but on the wire. I know that sounds strange, but I'm pretty sure it's a reality. There's various ways you can test that and confirm it. Now I make the half-wave dipole physically shorter. Instead of 132 feet long, I make it 167 feet long. Now, instead of that signal bouncing back and forth 30 times, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it's got to bounce 60 times before it radiates. The Q goes up. Q is defined in three or four different ways. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, stored energy per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. There's four definitions of Q. You make the antenna fit.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You make the antenna physically shorter, but electronically resonated, re-resonated. The signal bounces back and forth a higher number of times. That's why the Q is going up. That's why the bandwidth is going down. The tips of the dipole now have much higher voltage. The center of the dipole has a much lower resistive component of impedance. So the center of the dipole, the resistive component, is going down. The tips of the dipole, the voltage is going up. Now, is it because the voltage is going up that it still radiates as well? I'm not sure. Is it because the signal is bouncing back and forth more times and the Q is going up that it has the effective capture area that stays the same, even though physically it's smaller? It's a possible explanation there. And your explanation was the current is increasing even though the voltage at the center is going down. Well, you've got to be careful now. The center voltage, because the antenna, when it's shorter, becomes highly capacitive, there's a great big peak voltage at the center, but the resistive component of it is small. You put in a series inductor to re-resonate it with that series capacitance to bring it to get rid of the reactance as far as the feed point is concerned, and what's left is a resistor that used to be 72 ohms and now maybe it's 20 ohms. It's a much lower number. And you look at Chapter 4 of the Antenna Handbook, and you look at that curve, and you'll see exactly what the new resistance is and what the new reactance is. In other words, the Antenna Engineering Handbook on Chapter 4, Diagram 4-3 and 4-4, I think it is, has every possible length of monopole of every possible diameter, and the guy who took all that data way back in the 1940 time frame measured all of those impedances for you. And a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So that data is telling you exactly what your dipole is going to do. You select the diameter of the wire of your dipole. You select the length of the dipole. You calculate it in wavelengths. You go to that curve, and it'll tell you exactly what the impedance is going to be. Resistive component and reactive component. Somebody's been there, done that. The data is all there. You can predict it ahead of time. You don't even have to model it. That was back in the days before they had computers, in the dark ages, so to speak. So, explaining how the effective capture area of a short dipole stays the same.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'll admit that that, with good common sense, it's a difficult concept to get across. But lots of guys have done it. Isopole, among other companies, have made extremely physically small antennas in wavelengths that, if you're smart enough to use them correctly, give you essentially full performance over the very narrow bandwidth that's left in that antenna because of the higher Q. So, did the voltage go down? Yeah, the resistive component did, but the antenna became highly reactive. So, if you include what's going on with the impedance matching network at the center of that short dipole, there's a great big voltage there, and on the tips of the dipole, the voltage probably has doubled. What stops you from making the dipole shorter and shorter and shorter is eventually become so narrowband, the circulating currents become so high, the number of bounces become so high, the voltage at the tips of the antenna become so high, that eventually the antenna will arc over the air. Literally. It becomes harder and harder to build the components losslessly with that higher Q of network, and as I said, eventually the voltage becomes so high and the bandwidth becomes so narrow that you sort of give up. You're not going to build an 80-meter dipole that's 1 inch long. Guarantee you'll arc over the air when you resonate it. But up to that point, you can keep the performance, even though it sounds crazy. You guys are going to have to hear this a number of times before it sinks in and makes some sense. And maybe I've made a couple of errors, but I can tell you where this data is coming from. And it's not not all created by me. KC2, I think it's OJO, OO, I can't read my own writing here, Howard. KQRW, you got it, Howard.
Yeah, I got a comment on this, that KQKY, that may be a good light on it.
Okay, Howard first and then Mel in that order. Howard, go ahead.
Me too.
Dick, I think we're violently agreeing. What I was saying is that I agree that the power is the same when you resonate, whether the antenna is long and or short. But one way to look at it is that as you look at the output of that antenna, the resistance is going down so that with constant power, the voltage is going down. The square of the voltage should be going down roughly as fast as the resistance, and that also explains the bandwidth. But I do agree that the power will be the same, the received power or transmitted power. However, it looks a little differently at the input.
I think we're seeing is resonating, Dick. That means the load too. How come the signal is bouncing 30 times? Where is the bounce coming from? Where is the reflected wave coming from?
Okay, I'm going to answer this one and then I'm going to go over to Mel. As I said, we all want to believe on a full half-wave dipole on, say, 80 meters, 132 feet long, wire. We want to believe that we measure the center impedance of 72 ohms, and it looks like a pure 72 ohm resistor. And if I put a pure 72 ohm real dummy load resistor there, the signal would flow down the transmission line once, go into the dummy load, get absorbed, turned into heat, and it's gone forever. But instead I put it into my half-wave dipole, and I make all my standing wave measurements on my transmission line. From my transmission line's point of view, I can't see any difference between the dummy load and the real half-wave dipole. Therefore, you and I want to think that the signal leaves the transmission line, the signal goes on to the wire of the dipole, the 14-gauge wire. We want to believe the signal flows down that wire once and jumps into space. Only something like 3% of that energy jumps into space on the first pass. 97% of the energy is left when it comes down to the end of the wire. The end of the wire is an open circuit. The signal hits that open circuit and reflects back. 97% of the energy, or 95%, something like that, comes back to the feed point.
And the antenna?
On a half-wave antenna, yes.
The antenna is not resonating.
Yes, it is. That signal...
Oh, man, if it's resonating, it should absorb everything.
Okay. When I resonate an LC network, are you telling me that the signal enters that parallel LC network only once, and it doesn't ring like a bell? Is that what you're telling me, Alex?
In a parallel LC network, when it is resonating, the signal just bypassing the whole network because it represents a very high impedance for it.
Au contraire. If I instantaneously disconnect the transmission line that goes into your LCR network, you've got a parallel inductor, a parallel capacitor, and a parallel resistor, and it's resonating at 3.7 megs, and you're putting one watt of energy into it, and I instantaneously disconnect the feed line to that LCR network, but it's connected to an extremely high impedance oscilloscope, I will see that signal ring down for the next 1,000 cycles of stored energy in that resonator. Over to you, Alex.
Because this resonates, but don't forget, antenna is not resonating. We are faking its resonance. We're adding a resonating circuitry between the antenna and the cable, okay? This is where the whole caboose starts to begin to be crazy. Because here, between the resonating cable, the resonating network and the generator, you don't have any bouncing anymore. You will have bouncing only between this and the antenna itself.
The plane is weak. If I had standing wave ratio on the transmission line, signal is bouncing back and forth. In the examples I'm giving, there is no standing wave ratio on the transmission line. Assume I've got a simple transmitter, a transmission line, no standing wave ratio, 72 ohm antenna. You'll admit that when I tune the antenna to 3.7 megs and I go a little bit low in frequency, the antenna looks like a great big capacitor. If I go up in frequency, it looks like a great big inductor. That's exactly what an LCR network does. If I go down in frequency, it looks like an inductor. If I go up in frequency, it looks like a capacitor. The reactance moves real fast versus frequency.
Well, you need a network then, an adapting network, if the antenna is resonating to your cable.
Assuming I'm using no adapting resonating network, I'm keeping it simple. I've got a 72-ohm twin lead going straight into a 72-ohm half-wave full dipole in free space. Will you admit that when I go a little bit low in frequency, the antenna becomes a capacitor? The reason it becomes a capacitor is because I've gone to a lower frequency where the wavelength is longer, the signals bouncing back and forth on the antenna no longer stay in step. I start getting a leading phase because the length is no longer appropriate for that wavelength.
Okay. We're talking CW, not modulation here. I don't know. All right. You know, we can turn it out always around. But when you're doing a CW signal on it, the frequency should remain the same and the antenna should absorb everything.
Without a doubt, the antenna is absorbing everything, but it doesn't do it on the first pass. You'll admit that you take that dipole you've tuned to 3.7 megs, and you're running key down CW, and I go a little bit lower, I turn the dial on my transmitter down to 3600 instead of 3700. You'll admit the antenna becomes a capacitive reactance.
That's no problem. I understand that. So what is your point here, Dick?
How did it become a capacitor reactant if it wasn't a whole lot of bounces that start falling out of phase? How did the dipole do that?
Well, wait a second. We are not talking about the same thing. We're talking about a very specific frequency that is resonate, that the antenna resonates to. That's what we started the discussion for. Now you're trying to get me on a different path that is really obtuse here, you know. Do you want me to explain how can an antenna become the capacitive or inductive depending on its frequency? It's not only the antenna, it's the whole system. The cable becomes too, because you cut the cable to a specific length to do that. Your cable cannot be an arbitrary length if you are not considering the frequency.
Hold on now, Alex. Make believe all of my instrumentation is right at the antenna. No feed line at all. You'll admit the antenna has a finite Q. It's got a finite bandwidth. That bandwidth is telling you that there is cycling reactive energy in it. I'm saying the signal bounces back and forth on the wire. In your LCR network, the signal bounces back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. Stored energy is in those reactances. that antenna has stored energy. The signal bounces back and forth many times.
Other than that, when the antenna is resonating, all of those reactances disappear. You have a pure resistance here.
When I have my LCR network with the stored energy, where the energy really is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and capacitor, I'm at resonance and I see nothing but the resistor. Are you telling me there is no stored energy in the inductor and capacitor of an LCR network? Go ahead.
I'm not telling you anything, Dick. All that I'm saying it is that the reactance or resonance disappears. The LC network becomes a resistor, and all your power is now dissipated as thermal radiation. That is the textbook explanation. This is why Mr. Hicks didn't believe that. So this is why we're spending so much money now. But we can argue, as you said, until tomorrow. The issue is here that for our purposes, on resonance, the antenna becomes a resistor. That's all.
I can take a parallel LCR network, a resonating tank circuit, and at the frequency of where I have tuned it, I measure the input impedance and I see a pure resistor. Will you admit that there is still stored energy in the inductor and capacitor? The inductive capacitance, the reactance, capacitor reactance happens to equal each other. That's what you and I call resonance. I can instantaneously disconnect the source of signal, and in my oscilloscope, I will see it ring down for the next 1,000 cycles with an exponential decay. Even though it is a pure resistor on measurement at resonance, it still has a significant amount of stored energy in that inductor and that capacitor.
When you disconnect the generator, you're changing the impedance to the network, and this is why it rings down. You have no more impedance matching on its input.
Okay, I'll do it by turning off the signal generator, and I'll watch it ring down. It'll ring down twice as fast because I've got a little bit more load on it, but it'll still ring down for 1,000 cycles with an exponential decay. Do you agree with that?
Well, I can agree that it will ring down several times, but not 1,000 times, because the dumping effect of the internal resistor will remain quite high. So you have two loaded 32 ohm or whatever fictitious resistor, the ohm resistor on your generator, plus the cable and so forth. The ringing, though, is done because of the cable itself and the capacitor and the inductance of the cable, and not because of the LC.
Don't agree. Assume now, Alex, that you have selected a capacitor that has 10 ohms of capacitor reactance. You put across it an inductor that has 10 ohms of inductive reactance, but you load it with a 1,000 ohm resistor. My signal generator is 1,000 ohms. Obviously, it has a Q of 100. When I instantaneously turn off that signal generator, I will watch it ring down with a Q of 100. I will see at least 1,000 cycles when I turn off that signal generator. Do you agree or disagree?
Okay, let's agree. Let's not get over that. Okay, Dick, don't worry about it. We'll play along with it, and we'll see how it comes on the bench in the simulators. By the way, you have ADS?
M2EO, Dick.
I hear you, Rich. Stand by. Believe me, Alex, you will eventually, I think, agree that a dipole in resonance, the signal does not jump off the dipole on the first pass down the wire. If it did, there would be no energy left. There would be no energy reflecting off the end. Therefore, when I went up and down in frequency, I would see no change in the impedance. If all the signal jumped off the wire on the first pass, the dipole would be infinitely broadband. There would be nothing left at the end to bounce back. There would be no resonance phenomena. You have to have bouncing energy to have resonance. If the energy jumped off the wire on the first pass, the dipole would have infinite bandwidth, and I could use a piece of wire on any frequency I wanted to. Over to you on that one, Alex.
Well, this is why you have a pump, which is called a tube or a transistor. This continues to pump energy into your load. Anyhow, okay, no, don't worry about it, Dick. I understand where you're coming from, what you're doing there. It's just a matter of, we're talking about the same thing, but on a different language. I'm sorry for that. Let's not dwell on that because we're taking the whole time of the net.
You may think we're wasting the net time. There's some very important points that you and I are making back and forth to each other. This is an area that's highly misunderstood. Where does the real radiation from an antenna come from? Highly misunderstood. Mel is now going to make it a little bit clearer for us. After that, Rich is going to make it a little bit clearer for us. K2KEY, put your two cents into this one, Mel. This is a good subject because it's a basic chunk of physics that we as antenna tinkerers, as ham radio operators, the more smarts we get in this area, the better the antennas we're going to create, the better we're going to understand what's going on, the better we're going to know why certain antennas work well. And when you set up some of these antennas at a flea market, at a field day site, they don't work so well. We're eventually going to have a better understanding of all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ with the comments. We're down the line.
Glenn recognized you first. Go ahead, Rich.
Whose point is this?
Sorry about that. Mel? K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Dick, I've gone through this a number of times with people. I've stood in front of a class and whatever, but only way I basically got the first time I heard this, of course, I also maybe took the argument similar to Alex and all, but the best demonstration I saw of this is the work that Jerry Civic, W2FMI, did on a whole series. In fact, he did a whole series of articles, which I have bound together, because it's the only one that really made such sense step by step, and he called it How Short Can You Get? And Dick, it's his experiment. Unless he had people standing there witnessing it, he was called that it's not possible what he was proposing. And when they stood there, he asked them, so explain what I am doing, the magic I am doing. But it was a very interesting experiment on what they called how he did it. But how he was able to do it was the most amazing way. Called How Short Can You Get? And he covers this all years ago, Dick, over.
Yeah, he was on the front cover of QST magazine with his wife sitting under an umbrella in a beach chair on his front lawn. The support for that umbrella was the vertical ground plane radiator. It was the monopole that was doing the radiating, and the umbrella represented the capacitive top hat. And his wife was sitting there just showing what the antenna looked like. She didn't really sit there when he was radiating a kilowatt. I know that. But he was making very short monopole antennas, vertical ground plane antennas. And as long as he had enough ground plane radials so that he made his front lawn look like a sheet of copper, so to speak, with enough radials, and as long as he had the right impedance matching network at the bottom of that highly shortened radiator, he was getting near 100% efficiency on radiation. So you can make an antenna short. You can get the full performance out of it if you use the right materials. And, of course, it doesn't seem to make sense at first. But radiation is hard. Unless your antenna is a whole lot of wavelengths long, like a rhombic or a beverage. It's the only antennas where the signal goes down there once. It's a so-called traveling wave antenna. Every other dipole you and I have ever built, you look at the right section of the books, it'll call it a standing wave structure. The dipole itself is a standing wave antenna.
Wave frequencies.
When it's a standing wave antenna, that means the signal has to bounce back and forth multiple times on the wire of the dipole itself before it gets radiated. That's what standing wave means. Even at resonance. N2EO, I know you wanted to make a comment on this one, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. In your N2EO, in your example of an LCR network, I think you've got the inductor is minus J 90 degrees, the capacitor is plus 90 degrees J, two on opposite, and they cancel. And what's the point I was going to make? When you disconnect the generator, you get circulating currents that should break down and dissipate through the heat through the resistor. Am I correct, Dick?
Yes, and whether you disconnect the signal generator or just turn off the signal generator, it makes a slight difference in the resistive loading impedance on that LC network, but in either case, the J90 in your case and minus J90, the minus J90 for the capacitor, the plus J90 for the inductor, plus that resistor, there is stored energy there. Yes, the inductor reactants and the capacitor reactants cancel. At that steady state frequency, when you make an impedance measurement, you see nothing but the resistor, and we say that that's resonant. It doesn't stop the fact that there's stored energy in that capacitor, in that inductor. The stored energy per cycle versus the energy dissipated per cycle, that's one of the definitions of Q. The stored energy will ring down over the next 1,000 cycles or so when you turn off the signal generator. You can watch it decay exponentially on your oscilloscope. Your antenna will do the same thing. You turn off the signal generator on your half-wave dipole and have an oscilloscope connected to the center of the half-wave dipole, you will watch the dipole ring down. There's stored energy on that dipole, even though you don't see it. You see a pure 72-ohm resistor when it's exactly the right length, but you can watch the dipole ring down. I have done that experiment. It's an
on that phone, a network analyzer, and I didn't see that.
Then you didn't look at it the right way. The ring down is going to take place in a couple of microseconds. What was the time scale on your oscilloscope?
I have a digital scope. It will trigger and store on the on everything. I understand what you're saying, Dick. However, this stored energy in the LC network, the virtual LC network there, is dissipated in the virtual resistance that is there. You cannot ring it down. There is no possibility. You have to have a detector. Tell me how you detect that. How did you see it?
It is not stored energy equal and opposite in the inductor and inductor and capacitor. It's stored, it's equal and opposite. The impedance is high. You don't see it. When you turn off the generator, it ring down, dissipate through the resistor. Am I making sense?
Yes, the load resistor that's there, whether it be the radiation resistance in the case of the dipole, or in the case of an LCR network, whether it be the real load resistor you put there, or whether it be the load created by your signal generator that is there, it's another virtual resistor, it's a real impedance. In any case, the stored energy in the inductor in the capacitor oscillates back and forth. At the peak of the voltage of the sine wave, at the peak, somebody's talking on top of me, at the peak of the voltage of the sine wave, all of the stored energy is in the capacitor, 1/2 CV squared, joules. And at that instant of time, at the peak of the sine wave, the current in the inductor went through zero. There is no stored energy in the inductor at that instant. A quarter of a cycle later, when you go through 0 volts, there is no energy in the capacitor, and all of the stored energy is in the inductor. And they oscillate back and forth as with...
You're smart.
They oscillate back and forth as to where the stored energy is, but they're still in the LC network, the LC portion of the network. The stored energy is there, and it rings down over the next 1,000 cycles or so, depending on how sensitive your oscilloscope is. When you did that experiment, Alex, and you said you did not see a ring down, what frequency were you doing? What was the network? And what was the impedance of your oscilloscope? And what time frame were you using on the oscilloscope? You had to see it. I've seen it many times. I'm wondering why you did not. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Well, frequencies, 2.4 gigahertz, full wavelength antenna, dipole, very short cable, and I think this is our problem, Dick. Now that I remember what happens, it is the stored energy in the feeder that you see ringing and not the one in the load.
I did it with the signal generator right at the antenna. No feed line. I saw the ring down of the antenna. By the way, when you do it at 2.5 gigs, where each complete cycle is a fraction of a nanosecond. Unless you've got a damn fast sampling oscilloscope, you're not going to see that. And by the way, a sampling oscilloscope will only display a phenomena that is repetitive from cycle to cycle. That's the way the sampling oscilloscope works. It moves its phase of the sampling measurement 1 degree on each measurement, and it assumes that all the sine waves are the same. You may not be able to see this on a sampling oscilloscope. It's looking for a steady state signal, and you didn't have one. You were looking at an exponential decaying signal. Over to you, Alex.
What can I tell you, Dick? I took all the precautions to see everything that's happening there. We went so far to detect, even to build our own detectors to see if that happens. I read all that stuff and I wanted to prove it to myself, and I couldn't prove it. I understand what you're saying, I understand what everybody is saying, but I couldn't prove it on my desk. And I have a $40,000 oscilloscope, and I have a $50,000 spectrum analyzer and all that crap that goes with it. I had at the time when I did that. We had a sampling oscilloscope running at 20 gigahertz. So, what do you want, Mark? I mean, we had the state-of-the-art tools, and I couldn't see it. As long we kept the cable very, very short, I couldn't see any ring down from the load. Once we got with the cable about 20 wavelengths, then I started to see it. Well, that's another story. Well, Dick, I promised I'd go back to sleep, and I didn't keep my promise. What do you know about it? This time, I really go to sleep.
KC2OJO with a comment.
OJO, you're after Glenn. Alex, I'm awful glad you signed in tonight. You and I are trying to understand one of the rather complicated chunks of what Mother Nature really does, and it's not easy. Glenn is going to make it all a lot more clear for us. KC2QIQ. K2RW. You got it, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. And just a small comment about, these shortened dipoles and shortened antennas. One of the antennas I've been experimenting with now for at least quite a few years is the screwdriver antenna on the mobile. And here's an antenna that's very, very short. The whip is only 6 feet long. And I can operate that on 75, 80 meters very, very well, where basically the base loading coil is retuning. The body of the car is the ground plane. And when I match the antenna and study it with an antenna analyzer right at the connector at the bottom of the antenna, you can see that the match right there is a beautiful match at 50 ohms, very, very narrow frequency match. But the performance of the antenna is fantastic. granted, it becomes location sensitive to where you are with the vehicle, to what kind of overall performance you have. But one of the things I noticed as a downside is that as the dipole becomes shorter, or the antenna becomes shorter from its full wavelength, or the half wavelength of the antenna, instead of having the flat takeoff angle from the antenna, as the antenna is getting smaller, it tends to be more like the isotropic antenna, where you're radiating up, down, and sideways, so you're losing a little bit of gain that way. But then again, with the good tight ground plane on the car, it still seems to operate quite well. Over to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
That screwdriver antenna is a rather popular antenna on mobiles, and I guess people have used them all the way down to 80 meters, and there may even be a version that goes down to 160. And your counterpoise, your stored energy location, well, your transmitter really is a pump, and it's pumping electrons into the right-hand side of a dipole on the first half cycle, and it subtracts them from the right-hand side and pumps them into the left-hand side of the dipole on the second half of the cycle. Your transmitter is a pump. It's your transmitter is a pump. It's moving electrons. The electrons create current. The current creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field gets radiated into space. That's one way of explaining how radiation takes place. In the case of a full, symmetric, half-wave dipole, the electrons are bouncing back and forth between left and right side. In the case of a ground plane antenna, your other half of the dipole is missing. You've got this great big sheet of metal, if it's the ideal world, and the other half of the missing dipole is the mirror image in the sheet of metal. Well, in the case of an 80-meter transmitter on an automobile, the automobile is the counterpoise. It's nowhere near big enough. Therefore, it sort of becomes the second half of a dipole, and it's a non-symmetric antenna. The automobile becomes hot. And whether you drive it over dry soil, wet soil, sandy soil, or whatever, you'll get slightly different performance. Because the automobile is part of the radiation, very similar to what happens with a handy-talkie. Let me drop. In the case of a handy-talkie, you think the rubber ducky is doing all the radiating. The other half of that antenna is the metal case of the radio itself, the hand that's holding onto it, and the arm that's holding onto the hand. If you did a real good visualization in a good anechoic chamber of a man holding onto a handy-talkie, probably 60% of the radiation is coming from the rubber duck. The other 40% is coming from the rest of the radio, the hand, and the arm of the guy holding it. All of it is hot. Very similar to what happens when a guy runs his radio-controlled model airplane at 72 megacycles. The human body standing straight up and down comes very close to resonating at 72 megacycles. So half of the radiation is coming from the antenna, half of it is coming from the human being holding onto the radio. You can prove that to yourself by turning around backwards so that the airplane is behind you, and the airplane gets your signal very equally as well. It almost doesn't see the difference. So where the real radiation is coming from sometimes is a little bit mysterious. Not quite sure where I was going with that, but I'm hoping it helps a little bit to explain what's going on. But in all of these cases, when we talk about a high Q antenna because it's short in size, we'll admit that the shortness of size creates a more narrow bandwidth. Let me drop. The more narrow bandwidth is a fancy way of saying that as I move away from the tuned frequency, the antenna becomes reactive very rapidly. In the case of a dipole or a monopole, as I go down in frequency, it becomes a capacitive reactance real fast. As I go up in frequency from the design center, it becomes an inductive reactance real fast. Where did that inductor come from? Where did that capacitor come from? It was always there. Your equivalent circuit of that dipole is a series LCR network. And there's a lot of stored energy in that L and the C. You only see the R when you're at resonance because the L and the C reactants equal each other. But they're still there. There's still stored energy there. Otherwise, why would the Q go up? Why would the bandwidth go down when you make it shorter? The one explanation is the energy is bouncing back and forth between the tips of the dipole. In the case of an LC network, the energy is bouncing back and forth between stored energy in the inductor or stored energy in the capacitor. It's bouncing back and forth. And you can take an LCR network, I don't care if it's series or parallel, and you can suddenly turn off the signal generator with a good, fast oscilloscope, non-sampling oscilloscope, and you will watch it ring down. And it rings down for 100 or 1,000 cycles, depending on the Q. An exponential decay. You can measure the Q of any resonant network by measuring the ring down time. You can measure the Q of any resonant network by measuring the bandwidth. You can measure the Q of any resonant network by measuring the amount of stored energy in the inductor or stored energy in the capacitor. Make the measurement any way you want. The stored energy that rings down, and it does not instantaneously come out in one cycle. It takes 100 or 1,000 cycles. In the case of radiating, the signal doesn't just jump off that wire on the first cycle. That signal has to bounce back and forth on your antenna a significant number of times before the majority of the energy finally jumps off the wire and goes into space. You and I call that radiation. Once you accept that, you'll understand why every antenna you're going to build that you want to efficiently radiate, you will resonate it first. Then it can radiate efficiently. Let me drop. That simple 3-foot piece of wire you plug into the back of your center conductor of your receiver on 80 meters. It receives, but it's 30 dB down. It's not resonant. And you try transmitting into it. If your transmitter could take it, nobody but the next door neighbor is going to hear you. Because you're 30 dB weaker than you should be. You're QRP, if you know what I mean. Radiation is hard. The signal you're putting into that antenna that you wish to radiate, you have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times in a row before it finally leaves. That's the bottom line of all this. Radiation is not easy. That's why we're studying it. That's why we tinker with it so much. That's why antennas behave so differently sometimes than the way you think they should. Radiation is not easy. You have to really work at it. Who wants to add or subtract from all of this? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay,
okay, that was a perfect 10 tipple. I heard N2EO, I heard OJO. Who else was in there?
WB2EAV.
EAV. Who else was in there? Okay, that's more than enough. N2EO, I think I heard you. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I don't fully understand it, but I kind of grasp it, and I think the reason why people don't grasp it is because an antenna doesn't look physically like a lumped inductor or a lumped capacitor. It's a linear capacitor and a linear inductor on a three-element of whatever element beam directs the capacitor, then the reflector is inductive. So you've got leading and lagging voltages. That's basically how it works. That's all I wanted to say, Dick. And it has to be a tuned circuit, because if you move up and down in frequency, you've got a passband curve there.
Exactly like an LCR. The equivalent circuit of a dipole is a series LCR circuit to the first approximation. And you can select the value of the capacitor, you can select the value of the inductor, and you can select the 72-ohm resistor, and if you select them correctly, and you put them in a black box, it will act exactly like your dipole in the vicinity where you have tuned it, and up and down a little bit around that region. You go far away, and you get some funny harmonic effects. I won't go there. But in the near receiver, in the near region, you can make a beautiful equivalent circuit of an LCR for your dipole, and by definition, either of those networks have stored energy. And it will ring down over some significant number of cycles if you suddenly turn off the signal generator. Howard, KC2OJO, you got the floor, K2LIW.
Real quick, Dick, would you really send you to stabilize the circuit?
That's one way of looking at it. Howard, you got it?
Dick, I was going to say, I think the real problem is when people say that the half-wave antenna is a resistor. And I think we don't even have to talk about going above the higher frequency or a lower frequency, because when you have a half-wave antenna, it's obvious there's a high voltage at the end, a low voltage and high current at the center, and therefore it may, over a long term, act like a resistor, but it's obvious that unless there were waves traveling back and forth, you couldn't have the voltage varying across the antenna. That it obviously is acting like a resistor and a capacitor and has stored energy, and that the waveforms are bouncing back and forth, or you wouldn't have the standing waves that you see on the antenna. So I think...
Howard, are you still there? You suddenly dropped out.
Yes, I'm still here. I was saying that the antenna may have resistive properties, but certainly the fact that we see a high voltage at the end and a smaller voltage and high current in the center indicates that the standing waves are there due to signals bouncing back and forth.
Give that man a cigar. You got it, Howard. Howard, I suddenly hear the sound. Brethren, you have the faith. Is that correct, Howard?
Dick, I've had it all along. The only reason I mentioned the voltage phenomena is I felt that what was happening is the fact that the resistance is going down, so the Q is going up, also indicates that the voltage, in a sense, must be going down, certainly at the center point, in order to keep the power constant.
There we got a little bit of a problem. The resistance goes down when it becomes shorter, the resistive component. But the antenna itself becomes highly capacitive, reactive, when you make it shorter and you didn't put in a loading coil on the antenna itself or zigzag it or put on top hat capacitors. So there is a lot of reactance left over. And from one point of view, the total voltage at the center doesn't go down quite the way you want it to. The in-phase voltage, the resistive component, yes, it goes down. But the tip voltage goes up, and even the center voltage, because of that big reactance, goes up. So life's a little bit complicated there. But in general, I'm agreeing very much with what you said. Let's see what Mr. Gellar has got to say. WB2EAV. WB2EAV? It's Mr. EAV. Go right ahead, And are you on your constitutional, K2RIW?
Yes, I'm on my constitutional. I'm starting to get the effects of mustache icing. My indoor outdoor thermometer before I left the house at 22 degrees.